Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm joined today by Mr. Ian Wright. Ian is a consultant orthopaedic surgeon at Nobles Hospital. Welcome, Ian, and thank you for coming, and we really do appreciate you taking the time to join us today. Using Ian's usual job title there, you may wonder why I've invited an orthopaedic surgeon to join us here today. As I have explained on a number of occasions, many aspects of hospital and community healthcare have been reshaped as we respond to meet the challenges of COVID-19 and the demand it places on our services. One of these changes includes surgery, with only emergency procedures currently taking place. This not only means that we have fewer people in hospital recovering from surgery, people who would be in a weakened state, potentially vulnerable to the disease, but it also enables us to use the resources from our theatres to increase our intensive care capacity in terms of bed space and equipment. The benefits these changes bring in our ability to provide care at scale for people with COVID-19 is not solely about physical capacity, however. Of course, the number of beds and ventilators we have available is crucially important. But our most precious resource in our battle is our people. Adapting and reconfiguring our services is allowing us to redeploy our people into new vital roles. Ian is an example of this service reconfiguration. Instead of his normal duties, undertaking major surgery, replacing people's joints and the like, Ian has instead been lending his skills in the field of modelling to help us understand how COVID-19 might spread here in the Isle of Man. Taking Ian as an example, whilst not demonstrating his surgical skills and prowess with a scalpel at present, we are tapping into Ian's first class honours degree in mathematics, which included work on mathematical modelling. Ian also undertook a postgraduate diploma in actuarial science, which involves applying rigorous mathematics to model matters of uncertainty. So we are very lucky to have someone with his qualifications as part of our modelling team. This work has been absolutely critical in shaping the response to COVID-19 on our island. From helping the Council of Ministers to determine government strategy, to on-the-ground planning at Nobles Hospital on matters such as oxygen and personal protective equipment. Not a day goes by without talking about the curve. And so there is, of course, a great deal of interest in the modelling behind these graphs, given how important this sort of scenario planning has been in shaping the policy response in countries around the globe. That is why Ian has kindly agreed to come along today to explain more about our modelling. Before I continue, it is important for me to note that the adaptability people are showing is not unique to the field of health and social care. Right across the Isle of Man government, as well as in so many parts of our community, people are rising to the challenge to help us fight this disease head on. Across the Isle of Man government, I can confirm that hundreds of public servants have been redeployed from their normal duties, staff from every government department. Public servants volunteering to change roles and go where they are needed, such as our learning and development trainers helping to staff our COVID 111 service. People normally based at the NSC transferring to support the housekeeping team at Nobles Hospital. DOI workers assisting with hospital security, and our bus drivers supporting the ambulance service. And this does not include staff who have been redeployed within their existing teams or departments. For example, I know the Treasury and the Department for Enterprise have rearranged staffing internally to meet the surge in demand for the various schemes we have created to help businesses and individuals through this extremely challenging time. I cannot thank you enough. This is a real team Isle of Man effort, and those efforts are bearing fruit. Before I invite Ian to share some insight on our modelling, I would like to update you on today's figures. The first thing I need to tragically inform you is there has been a further death in our community and also a further death in hospital, bringing the total community deaths to 13, hospital deaths to 5, and the overall deaths to 18. A further 2 members of our island community have lost their life to this horrendous disease and left family and friends mourning the loss of their loved ones. Every death tears at the heart of our community and affects us all. We must all redouble our efforts and continue to fight against this disease to ensure as few families as possible lose their loved ones in this horrendous way. The total number of tests undertaken stands at 2,751. The total number of concluded tests stands at 2,715, so the number of people awaiting results is 36. The total number of cases testing positive is 308. That means there has been one new case since yesterday's update, and the presumed recovered now stands at 230. Before I hand over to Ian, I want to address a point I notice has come up on social media about testing. Some have suggested the low results over the last few days mean that the Ireland Testing Centre isn't working correctly. That is not correct. As explained last week, the testing centre went through robust secondary testing and validation procedures before going live, with tests being run both in Manchester and the island to make sure that the results were the same. That validation proved completely successful. Also, currently, we still have test results coming back from Manchester in the batches we are reporting. Not all are purely on island processed results, and they are also among the negatives seen over the last few days. And with that, it's my pleasure to hand over to Ian. Thank you, Ian.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. And thank you, Minister, for inviting me to this briefing today to explain a little bit about the mathematical modelling that's been done in an attempt to determine how the coronavirus epidemic might pan out on the island, how it was used to help guide the DHSC's preparations, and how it relates to what we've actually seen in the 5 weeks since the first positive case was identified here. The first thing to say is that a model is simply a tool to help preparations. It's not designed to make exact predictions as to exactly how many patients might be admitted on any particular day or exactly when the peak of infections will arrive. The basics of the model is that it is a mathematical function that gives a figure for how many new cases of COVID may appear on a given day. It's based on exponential growth, which is when the cumulative number of cases one day is a fixed multiple of the cases the previous day. We're probably all familiar with the R value, which in epidemiology is the basic reproduction number. It's a figure that indicates how many people each infected person will give the virus to. The exact number is unknown and depends on not just the virus itself, but how people behave. A reasonable estimate for illustrative purposes for coronavirus would be R equals 3. Another important number is the time a person is infectious for, which for COVID is about 5 days on average. So, if we have one case of COVID, in 5 days' time there will be another 3. Those 3 will infect 3 each over the next 5 days, and so on. In that way, we have a sequence that goes 1, 3, 9, 27, 81, 243, 729. I think that's gone far enough, but you can see it doesn't take very long until infection is widespread. Can I have the chart up, please? A similar function was entered into an Excel spreadsheet with a slight modification to take into account that cases can't keep growing forever as you eventually run out of people to infect. And this was used to generate the curves that we're all familiar with and we can see on the screen now. The curves are presented as a set of 3 with a different daily growth rate. The blue curve, with the highest and soonest peak, is a daily growth rate of 20%. In the first version of the model, we used 29%, as this was the figure calculated from the early phases of the epidemics in Italy and Spain, and I thought this probably represented the worst case scenario. It was changed to 20% because this is the growth we actually saw on the island before the effects of the lockdown 4 weeks ago came into being. So the blue curve represents what may have happened here if the government hadn't brought in the restrictions in the latter half of March. The middle red curve represents a growth rate of 12%. you can see that the effect of reducing the growth rate, which is what happens when you reduce R by introducing all the stay-at-home measures, is to flatten the curve and push its peak to the right. In practice, this buys you time to prepare the health service by freeing up capacity, repurposing wards as intensive care units, training staff to run them, and reduces the level of peak demand so that your enhanced health service can cope, rather than ending up in a war zone situation, dreadful scenes of which we probably all saw from northern Italy a month or so ago. The figure of 12% was what was seen in Germany, and what we thought would be achievable here. And so the red curve was used to guide planning at Nobles in terms of extra intensive care beds, dedicated COVID ward beds, PPE requirements, oxygen need. The orange curve represented what we thought was aspirational, or a best case scenario. It was generated with an 8% daily growth, which was a figure I calculated we might achieve if our lockdown measures were successful in halving the R value. Since the lockdown measures took effect on about the 3rd of April, looking at the log plot of the actual case numbers here, our growth rate in cases has actually been lower than this so-called best case scenario. It's averaged only 5.5%, and that includes the outbreak in Abbotswood, which has accounted for the majority of the cases over the last 10 days or so. Without these, we've only had a few cases each day, and only one over the last 3 days, suggesting spread in the wider community has all but stopped. Health is probably the most obvious aspect of an epidemic to consider, but there are also major considerations with regard to society, psychological health, and of course the economy. The sooner we can get back to a more normal way of life, the better it will be for all these aspects. It's only sensible that plans to loosen the lockdown are gradual and monitored. Health is of course vital, and we must be confident that increasing cases of COVID that we'll be able to cope with them. We're currently well below the 12% growth used in the planning assumption, and calculations based on the small increase in R that may happen by letting the first sectors of the economy return to work indicate there should be a minimal effect on the current growth, which will remain below this figure. In fact, I'm fairly confident it will remain below the 8% best case scenario. But this will, of course, be monitored very closely, specifically looking at what happens in 8 to 10 days' time. The modelling has, in many respects, done its job. We now need to focus more on monitoring the real situation here, not just with positive cases, but also with calls to 111, ED attendances and bed occupancy. Testing, and I'd like to pay tribute to Rizwan Khan and his team for such a sterling effort in getting the island testing to the stage we have it today, remains vital if we're going to keep the virus under control on island while slowly getting back to some semblance of normal living. In the meantime, of course, it remains vital that we keep up the social distancing, hygiene and self-isolation if required. Thank you. Before I hand over to the Minister, I'd just like to take this opportunity, I'm not sure if I'm allowed or not, but to wish my little girl a happy birthday, as she's 15 years old today. Happy birthday, Sophie. Minister.
Thank you, Ian. You most certainly are allowed. And from me, happy birthday as well, Sophie. I hope you've had a good day, considering the circumstances that we're in. But happy birthday, Sophie. So thank you very much, Ian. I hope that for those of you watching and listening, it has been able to give you some insight into our modelling and has helped you to understand it a bit better. It demonstrates the rigour that goes into our scenario planning here in the Isle of Man and shows how experiences in other jurisdictions are actually helping to shape our response. And I will now invite questions from the media. And first up, I've got Amanda from Jeff the Mongoose.
Thank you very much, Minister, and thank you for all that information, Mr. Wright, and a happy birthday to your daughter. A question on the curves, the three curves that we've been seeing. Is it still possible in any sense that those projected curves are going to happen? If we have successfully squashed the curve, would a revised estimate with new observations make more sense to give us more of an idea of where we are?
Well, before I bring Ian in, just from my point of view, I think once we are past the peak point of what we were predicting would be our peak, then yes, it would make sense to go back and revisit where we think we may be going from there. But the important thing to emphasise is, I know we've had 2 days of 0-0 and now one, 3 days of 0-0 and now one, but we need to look at long-term trend data. And I know I've always sound very, very cautious around this, but that's what's important. We mustn't put all our hopes on the fact we've had 3 very good days. As Ian referred to at the end, and I've referred to in previous press conferences, changes and things that happen can take 8 days, 8 to 10 days to be able to actually see the results of that. So we need to get much more of a trend data before we can all start thinking about what needs to change. But I'll bring in Ian to add to that.
Yeah, it's sort of, as I said, the models are really just that, models to help you prepare. I'm not sure there's much value in creating a new model now to see how it's likely to go over the next month or two. I think really what we have to do is just maintain the monitoring that we've got and adjust the measures in place in society according to what actually happens rather than trying to predict what happens. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I understand. And for our second question, it's again for you, Mr. Wright, if that's okay. Yeah. The curves that we've been shown display exponential growth before they peak, driven by the rate of transmission, as you explained. Mm-hmm. They are smooth, indicating that the rate of transmission remains the same over time. Is this accurate, as transmission rate will be changing amid the relaxation and tightening of lockdown measures? And could you confirm for us what our estimated rate of R currently is?
To answer the last question, no. I can't confirm what the estimated R is. I view R as more of a means of communicating to indicate to people how many cases you're likely to generate if you get infected by whatever behaviour you've got. In terms of the curves being smooth, yes, they are. That's just for illustrative purposes. On the actual modelling we've done, you can put in different growth rates at each stage according to when measures are introduced, and you get all sorts of wacky-shaped curves. Which we have been looking at and studying, but for the purposes of displaying for the media and for the website, we thought the smooth curves just keeps it simple.
Would it be possible in any way to show the public a slightly more detailed version of that curve, just, you know, in the future, because people have more detail and more to sort of look into and read into themselves?
Well, again, it's possible, and I don't mind doing that, but these curves are now sort of historical almost. Mm-hmm. We could show you what the curve, we could make the model fit exactly the data we've already seen, and you'd see a wacky shaped curve that would pretty much fit the points that we've got. But that's less useful than monitoring now, I think.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, just to add to that, Amanda, I don't think there's much use in showing the absolute raw up and down peak curves. I think that could actually add confusion as well. Unless you're someone who's a qualified statistician and really into your stats, I don't think that adds anything. What is important, as Ian's laid out in his presentation earlier, is that peak point, because the whole point of this modelling is to work out where we were at the peak and whether our health services can cope with that peak. So everything we've done in the background has been about smoothing the curve out to make sure that the number of cases, even at its high point, remains within our service delivery abilities, and that's absolutely crucial. So that, I think, is the most important point. It's not about peaks and troughs of having 10, 11 cases any particular day. It's about ensuring that top line remains within our capacity, and that was the whole point of the modelling in the first place, to show where we believed we might be. Next up, I've got Dolan from Manx Radio.
Pastor Mai, Minister, very sad to hear the news about 2 further deaths on the Isle of Man, one in the community, one at Nobles Hospital. We heard Mr Wright there speak about Abbotswood Nursing Home as being the outlier. I believe all 12 deaths in the community thus far have been from that home. First of all, are you able to confirm a bit of an update on the condition of some of the people who have tested positive there? I think the last thing we heard, there were 47 positive tests there. And was the death today in the community also from Abbotswood?
The information I have is that the death today was in the, from the community, was from Abbotswood. I am waiting for final confirmation of that, but I would say it is at the moment pretty likely that it was. That is certainly the information I had coming into this briefing, but it hadn't been finally formally confirmed. Abbotswood most definitely is a concern, as I've said all along. DHSC has stepped in to assist the home. In terms of the condition of individuals, it differs because obviously we've got to remember, as I mentioned at the briefing yesterday, that people within a nursing home tend to have other health conditions. So there is underlying conditions. There is people within the home who would have been classed as end-of-life patients through other conditions as well. So it is a mixed picture. We are providing what care, the appropriate care to individuals who have got the disease. And unfortunately, that is as much information as I can give at this time.
And secondly, it was interesting to hear Mr. Wright say he's fairly confident we're going to stay below the best case scenario from a statistical point of view. And we saw a bit of a easing of regulations today with some sectors allowed to go back to work, including construction. Anecdotally, we've seen there's been much more traffic on the roads today. Some people even commenting that it's felt like a bit of a return to normal. Are you still satisfied that soft reopening of those sectors is being done in a safe way? And do you think people have interpreted the changes correctly, Minister?
Yes, I do believe that it's been done in a safe way. There's been a lot of clinical and medical input into this. As I've described over the last few days, and the Chief Minister has also described, there's also guidance notes that sits behind this, particularly in relation to construction. One of the things that I need to emphasise as well is if you actually look at countries around the world, most haven't shut their construction industry. Germany, that is held up as an example, not just in our graph, but also is seen as a bit of a worldwide example as to how the tackling of the disease is going, never actually stopped their construction trade. So there is proven models around the world as to how construction can operate safely in the COVID-19 environment, so to speak, in the community. And those are the models that we are following. So there is appropriate health advice out there. As the Chief Minister has emphasised all week, there will be enforcement behind that as well. So anyone found breaching it, we will not hesitate to shut down. The other key thing to emphasise from a society point of view is we have not relaxed the rules on mass gatherings. Mass gatherings of two or more people. People should still be only with people who are in their household, so they shouldn't be meeting with wider family and friends. None of that has changed. I do think the Isle of Man public is very responsible. One of the things that has actually been shown by the lockdown period, the 3 weeks of lockdown we went through, was just how responsible people have been. As the Chief Constable said earlier in the week when he came to the press conference, the vast majority of people have acted responsibly. There will always be a minority of people who think the rules don't apply to them, and we will always have to deal with that. But that is under any circumstance. And I would like to again put on record my thanks to the Manx public for the way they have responded to the measures that we have taken, because it has impacted massively on their daily lives. So we're still far from normal. I need to make that absolutely abundantly clear. And it's going to be baby steps along the way. This is the first sort of toe in the water, so to speak. And as Ian laid out and the Chief Minister has laid out, if things don't work out as we expect them to, or we see any deteriorating trends, then we will have to consider next steps and actions taken.
Thank you.
Okay, next up I've got Leanne, 3FM.
Good afternoon, Minister.
Good afternoon, Leanne.
With the on-island testing facility now up and running, I understand that the main priority is to check whether people have coronavirus, but does the new facility give the option to carry out immunity testing? And if so, is this something that the island would consider?
Right, immunity testing, which I think I've addressed a couple of times before, but it's antibody testing. Now, at the moment, the antibody tests that have become available have not passed their regulatory approval standards because the accuracy rate of them has turned out to be, in some cases, 30% or less. I believe a lot of it was developed around the research that was done in China with people with COVID-19 and pneumonia and looking for particular antibodies that are produced, but it is certainly not appeared to be accurate at the moment. And one thing, certainly, I mean, the Chris Whitty, who is the chief medical officer in England, he always uses the phrase, and it's a phrase I fully agree with, that the one thing worse than no test is a bad test. And we do not want to be using testing that has 30% or less accuracy. So, but if an antibody test came on the market with regulatory approval that's been through its proper clinical trials that showed it was accurate, of course we would jump at the chance. But the most accurate form of test is the swab test that tells us if people have COVID-19 and allows us to break the chain of the virus, and that is what we are using.
And secondly, Braddon Cemetery reopened today. Has any more thoughts been given as to whether other cemeteries across the island will follow suit?
Yes, cemeteries have been considered as part of the relaxation proposals to allow people to go and see their loved ones. Social distancing obviously has to apply. You know, obviously, a lot of cemeteries are run by the local authorities, and there may be some local authorities or churches that decide for whatever reason they don't wish to reopen at this time. That's perfectly acceptable. But we have been looking at that and around the fact that social distancing still needs to apply, and the separate regulations, of course, around gatherings for funerals. OK, then next up, I've got Paul from MTTV.
Afternoon, Hello, Paul. Minister. Clearly, what Ian Roberts seemed to allude to there was next 8 days are going to be very critical, because obviously more people going back to work. Certainly, it looks busy out on the roads, and at petrol stations, it's been quite amazing for all accounts. Have you got a number in mind what is a good result? This will talk about the very first weekend of May, aren't we here? I mean, you know, if it's good, what is good, and what is bad in sense of getting more cases confirmed?
First of all, let me address what is bad. What is bad is if we see a continual rise of cases. Again, I need to get people away from this fixation of any one day's number. And that's why both myself, the Chief Minister, and Ian today have all referred to the 8 to 10 days, because any decision implemented today, the effect on the ground is about 8 to 10 days later, where you see that trend. So what you need to see is the trend over several days. So a particular spike of, say, 10 cases in one day, but the next day you might have zero, and you might have zero the day after. So that 10 would look worrying for that one day, but the overall trend data is what matters. So we need to look at that trend over the next 8 to 10 days to see where it is. As the Chief Minister said in his speech, I think it was on Tuesday when he announced these measures, we have to, you know, this will then govern what decisions we can make at future points. If we continue to see a low trend and we don't start seeing spikes in cases, then we can consider next steps after that. As I just said in an answer, I think, to Amanda, it's baby steps the whole way. We've got to take it stage by stage. So what will matter is the trend. So it's not putting a particular number on us. It's about the trend. If we start seeing an increase and a continued increase in cases, then obviously that trend is extremely worrying and action needs to be taken.
And keeping this R number under one, I presume, then. That's the magic bit, isn't it?
Well, that's an ideal position, Paul. But it's yeah. I don't think in a realistic world let's wait and see. I'm always very cautious. But an ideal position is seeing a flattening out. Okay. Now, obviously, we've seen a flattening out the last few days of 0, 0, and 1. I mean, that's an exceptionally good line if you look at those 3 days. But like I say, you need to be really looking at trend data of 8 to 10 days to give you a true picture.
Can you tell us how many NHS staff have contracted COVID-19 or are in quarantine?
No, I don't have that figure, Paul. I don't believe we collect the data in that way.
And just then, very quickly to add on, this new one that was found, this new case, was it part of a cluster or was it completely random?
Again, I don't have that information. Okay. It will depend upon the contact tracing being done, because the contract tracing, obviously, for today will still need to go through. So as I've explained before, when it comes to community identified cases, there is a time lag between that sort of information appearing on the system.
OK, thanks.
OK, next up, I've got Chris at Energy.
Good afternoon, Minister. How are the various sectors and jobs being classified when it comes to going back to work? Because there are people out there in a similar line of work to window cleaning, such as valeting, for instance, who are still being told to stay at home. And if they're a new business or they don't qualify for the financial support on offer, they remain out of pocket. And there is a major concern for those people.
Thanks, Chris. You did break up a bit there, but I think I got the gist of the question. In relation to valeting and everything else, window cleaning has been particularly picked along with horticulture because it is possible for them to do it at social distancing levels. They don't have to come into contact with other people. They will mow the lawn, clean the windows, leave again without actually having necessarily having to have contact with the householder. Valeting and other services around that is a very different matter. As I've said, we do continuously look at the different industries, but people have got to remember, and it is going to be frustrating for some people, that we need to take baby steps along the way. So unfortunately, there will be some associated services that may well say, well, why are they coming back, but we're not, because they don't quite meet within what we would term the social distancing rules. But there will be a next stage. When that next stage will be will depend upon our figures, as I've said in answer to Paul. But we are considering constantly our advice. And as the Chief Minister constantly uses the phrase, things change on a daily basis.
And I suppose it does go on a case-by-case basis, but how much notice will be given in advance for other sectors in regards to when they get back to work?
Well, in most cases, as with construction and everything else, we've tried to give about a week's notice for people to return. What we've got to remember, though, is that we're not forcing people back into work. As the Chief Minister emphasised, it is industries that are allowed to return if they wish to. So we're not saying to any private company, for instance, even a private company that does construction, you must go back to work. We are not saying that. That is a choice for the individual company to make. If they feel that it's not risk appropriate for them to do so, nobody has to go back to work. In that sense, that is a choice for that business to decide. We are only stating they can if they wish. They're no longer in the list of businesses that can't go to work, basically.
OK, thank you. And construction workers have obviously started going back today. Can we have an update on when work may recommence on some of the island's largest projects, such as Douglas Promenade?
That rests with DOI, so I don't know what DOI's thinking around that is, the Department of Infrastructure. That will be something that would need to be addressed by DOI as to when they are considering it. I believe they are scheduled to do a press conference at some point in the near future, and they may be able to answer that question. I do know they're taking a look at all the projects they've got, but again, it will come down to what control is around, what regulations and guidelines would need to be applied, including social distancing, including how they would be able to operate as a site. So the same things that are applying to the rest of the construction industry, DOI as a project manager would have to take into account that. So I would imagine, and I know for a fact they are going through looking at their various projects, but I would imagine they would have to assess that before they decide what, if anything, they can progress forward with. So it's not going to be an instant return. They will need to take time to actually assess the impact on those different projects.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next up I've got Sam at Alaman Newspapers.
Good afternoon, Emerson. As we've been going on here, I've been getting a message through about is if you could clarify whether the sad death in hospital was also related to the care home or whether that is a separate.
At the moment, I don't have that information. Literally, I received these figures about 10 minutes before I came into the press briefing here. I've always made quite clear that, you know, I want to give you the most up-to-date information that I have, but I don't actually have the information as to whether the person in the hospital was Abbotswood or not at this stage. But it's something I can probably answer when I next do a press conference.
Thank you. And this week in, I can't remember if it was Tim Wilkie, I think it was Tim Wilkie, There was a bit of a debate on masks, which a few of our readers have picked up on and sent us in questions about, where it was pointed towards. Chief Minister sort of alluded to the idea that there could be a change in policy. And people have obviously seen videos on social media since then about this and seen what's happened in Germany. And they're just wondering if we are staying as we are, or whether there will be a shift in advice, if maybe not policy.
Right. All advice that we give is constantly under review. As I've emphasised many times, things change on a daily basis. In relation to masks, the only change of advice I would imagine at this stage would be likely to say that for those, there is certainly no evidence emerging around the world that masks benefit the wearer in public. That the, you know, even Germany and other countries that have gone down this route have actually put into their advice that it doesn't protect the wearer. There is some slight scientific evidence around the world that if someone is asymptomatic, it may protect them from spreading it on. But equally, there's other studies. So, for instance, there's been a very recent study by Dr. Barroso in the US, who is an international expert on respiratory protection, who actually, from his analysis, said that even in relation to people wearing the mask, it may not protect, because in his words, sweeping mask recommendations will not reduce COVID-19 transmission, as evidenced by the widespread practice of wearing such masks in, and I apologise if I mispronounce this, Huaibei province, China, before and during its mass COVID-19 experience earlier this year. There's various other studies out there as well that have actually said that because of the type of masks people wear in public, the cloth masks, they're not airtight. So particles will continue. There was one study I know of that actually said it's those masks still allow 98% of airflow around. So it is a very mixed picture. And you mentioned Germany. One of the things I need to emphasise about Germany is they have not gone, despite the way some of the international media has portrayed it, for a complete mandatory mask wearing, as has been suggested. They've gone for mandatory mask wearing on their tube. But then after that, the advice differs by state within Germany, because Germany is a federal system. Some have mandated it for wearing it in supermarkets. Other states within Germany completely disagree with that advice, and their public health has turned around and said, no, we won't be doing that. And in fact, there was one state which I did have in front of me, but I've managed to lose, that actually wasn't even wanting to mandate it on the tube, because they said it wouldn't have any effect, but decided to fall in line because all the other states had. So they said it would cause too many difficulties if people were passing through different jurisdictions. So there is an absolute mix of messages out there. We've got some countries that were held up as examples of mask wearing, how it slowed the transmission of the virus. Two of those are Japan and the Czech Republic, who have now started to see exponential growth in their cases. The Czech Republic, for instance, brought in mask wearing on the 18th of March, where it became mandatory to wear it in public. And since then, their growth rates continued. So they brought it in on the 18th of March. The week after they implemented that, their cases rose from 522 to 1,654. The following week, they went up to 3,598. The week after, to 5,312. And as of today, I believe they now stand a week later at 7,188. So they, despite the mask wearing, they are still seeing exponential growth. And Japan is starting to see that in some of its figures as well, along with Singapore. So I think, you know, when it comes to mask wearing, we do continuously look at our data. Public health and our clinical leadership body will advise, but I would expect that any change would be more more suggestive than actually mandating mask wearing. OK, Amanda.
Yeah.
OK, Amanda, you've got another one.
Yes, another question on the data, if that's okay, Minister.
Yeah.
It was mentioned earlier about the information from the 111 calls and tracking hospital bed use. Will your analysis from this be made public as it is guiding government response?
Sorry, repeat the question again, Amanda. I just missed that slightly.
No, You mentioned earlier about the information you're using from 111 calls and tracking hospital bed use. Will that analysis be made public to guide, as it's guiding the government response?
Well, as I think I've said before, we are looking at a suite of information that we can put on the website and statistical data, and including 111 calls, etc., hospital admissions. That's all feeding into part of that. So we'll look at that in the data round as to what we'll be able to put out to the wider public. But we are very keen to get more data analysis out there.
Is there any expectation of when that might be put on the website?
It's being worked on. Our technology service is under a lot of stress and strain as it is. I don't want to start putting them under more stress and strain by them having a politician stood at a podium putting a deadline on them before, you know, that's not going to be realistic. Paul?
We've all been following Captain Tom Moore and his amazing, I'm still getting the latest number, £28.5 million going to the UK NHS or NHS England, probably. What's the best way for people in the Isle of Man to contribute to Manx NHS? Have you got one particular fund that people should be channeling their money towards if they want to show their you know, happiness, their respect and dedication to our own NHS?
One of the things that we are very lucky with here on the island is our charitable and third sector. We have numerous charities that raise funds, both for Ramsey Cottage Hospital, Nobles Hospital. So what I would suggest to people is they make donations via those charities, that they look, take a look and say, so we've got the Friends of Nobles Hospital, we've got the Henry Bloom Noble Trust, we've got the Friends of Ramsey Cottage Hospital. There is an absolute plethora of charities that raise money, and actually, and if people have a specific cause within the NHS that they wish to donate to, we've already had many offers of help, and I think I've said these press conferences before, I've been absolutely overwhelmed by the amount of offers that have actually come in. It's been absolutely stunning. And basically, I would say, look at what charities are available. If you want to make it more of a donation direct, or you want to fund something direct, then get in touch and we'll see what we can do to facilitate that. But we have been exceptionally lucky. And in the UK, you know, 28 million. I mean, that is an absolutely phenomenal amount.
And it's still going up.
And it's still going up.
If you want to give to the NHS staff, for instance, is there any particular fund for that? You know, to thank people besides buying them, Easter eggs, which is obviously out of date now, but things like that. Is there any way to thank the staff?
Well, I think, Paul, at the moment, it depends what people are wanting to donate to. If there's something very, very specific that they're wanting to help with, then if they get in touch, we'll see what we can do to facilitate that. I know there's been certain charities and businesses that have been doing food parcels for key workers, etc. One of them is going to be in my shout outs a bit later on, just to trail that up. But if people have got a very specific thing that they want to actually try and put money towards, then let us know and we'll see what we can do to facilitate it, because there's multiple different avenues that people might decide they want to give to. Okay, Dolan.
Hi, Minister. Today, for many people in the Isle of Man, was payday, and people's pay slips this month will look quite a bit different, perhaps for some people, than they might have done in previous months. We've had inquiries in the past couple of days still about people who haven't received Manx earnings replacement allowance, people who are still having problems, individuals and businesses, with falling through the net of government support, whether that be the different schemes available. The Isle of Man had some problems with relative poverty before this outbreak. Does government still have concerns that we're going to be left with maybe a more unequal society after this?
I mean, obviously there is concerns about the economic effect that this will have. Both the Treasury Minister and the Minister for Enterprise have done these press conferences where they've been very upfront about that and said it is a concern. I know Treasury and DfE have both been working exceptionally hard, both on the benefits side and also on the scheme side, to get things processed. I know some people have become very frustrated with the wait and the backlog, but they've been processing an exceptional amount of cases. I think I heard a figure this morning in relation to Treasury where they've dealt with 300 odd claims just in the last couple of days, which is a phenomenal figure to be processing through. I know that DfE is working hard over this weekend to try and make sure that the entire backlog is cleared of their cases. maybe it will be leading to the early next week. But, you know, all the staff in DfE and Treasury are pulling together, as I said in my opening remarks, about people being redeployed to get through those cases. So I know it is frustrating for people, and I know, you know, it's very worrying times for a lot of them. But I do know that Treasury and DfE are doing everything they can to process the schemes as quickly as they can. But they have seen, obviously, a large amount come in at one time, which has caused a backlog.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to the media. Now turning to the shout-outs for Howard's Heroes. Right on topic, going back to what I spoke about earlier in terms of redeployment, we've had a nomination for Emma Callow at the National Sports Centre. Emma has been instrumental in our efforts to arrange a number of the redeployments of public servants. So thank you very much, Emma. Your efforts really are very much appreciated. My second shout-out is for Alex Irving. Alex is a third-year medical student who is currently back home on the island from university. Alex offered his time to Nobles Hospital and is currently working as a volunteer on Ward 2. Alex has recently celebrated his 21st birthday, which he actually spent the day working on Ward 2. So thank you, Alex. Thank you for your commitment and many happy returns. Thirdly, a request for a shout out for Ballasalla Medical Centre and Costain Pharmacy in Ballasalla. Like all of our medical centres and pharmacies, these two important community facilities are under a lot of pressure at the moment, but still maintain their friendly and professional service. Also, the final one for today, Santander has donated 200 food care boxes for delivery to our community key workers. I know these have been very much appreciated, and I have seen some of the brilliant responses from workers who have received them. So thank you, Santander. So please do keep your nominations coming using the hashtag Howard's Heroes on Twitter. It's wonderful to be able to share and recognise just some of the remarkable things people across our community are doing in difficult times. Before concluding this briefing, I am conscious that today we have taken the next step in how we, as an island community, are responding to coronavirus. A step, yes, but as I've said, a baby one. I cannot emphasise enough how vital it is that you continue with the measures you have taken over the past few weeks. Your actions really do make all the difference. How each of us behaves is the true frontline battle against this horrible disease. Keep your distance. Stay at least 2 metres away from other people outside of your household wherever possible. If you can work at home, please do so. Do not mix with people outside of your household. If you are returning to work in construction or as a tradesperson, do so only where you can maintain a safe distance from your colleagues and customers. It is critical that close contact is avoided, and where that is not possible, please ensure that you apply the guidelines that have been put on the government website. Exercise and travel responsibly. Maintaining your distance is vital, but so is common sense. Now is probably not the time to try to take up rollerblading for the first time. We must avoid any unnecessary demand on our health and care services. And last, but certainly not least, wherever possible, stay at home. It is the safest place. Your own front door is the greatest defence against COVID-19. Thank you very much.